Accession number 10599, reel 4.
Major English, reel 4. You were telling me about Captain Sell and some story of...
Yes, well, as I was saying, on the return journey from northern Iraq, we again staged at Habaneer. And on that occasion, we did lose a rifle from these one of these expert Arab rifle thieves. And we duly reported the loss. And Harry Sell's job as staff captain was to report this to the local area headquarters. And he met an officer there who said he had been in a building which he described as a mosque, whether it was an active mosque, I don't know, and it was absolutely full of captured British Army equipment. All sorts, not only rifles, but machine guns, and I believe there was even a carrier in there, so it was a little bit of a problem.
Was this indicative of anti-British feeling in the area, or was it just their normal way of life?
I think it was a bit of both, perhaps. I think that those sort of people always valued a rifle as a possession which gave them a certain status and which could well be useful perhaps on some similar occasion. And this was a source of weapons, so let's have a go at that. I mean, I think if it had been any other nation's soldiers, they would have been targets just the same. Of course, there had been the Iraq Rebellion, in which there was quite a, earlier on, which was quite a battle at Habaneer, actually, before that was put down. That was before we got there, of course.
So how far up into Iraq did you go?
Well, we, as I was saying, we reached Habaneer, and then we moved on east to Baghdad. And there, they obviously weren't too happy, the authorities weren't too happy about the political situation in Iraq, and there was undoubtedly around Baghdad anyway a certain amount of anti-British feeling, and we were ordered to put on all our equipment, steel helmets and everything, and sit in the lorries with rifles between our knees and more or less sit at attention, to give an impression of soldierly strength, I suppose, when we went through Baghdad. And then we drove on north and to near Kirkuk, which of course is one of the main oil centres of Iraq. And there we were there for a few days, sorting things out. And we were a little intrigued with the notice we saw there. It said, "Beware of the tarmac roads." And we thought, well, this is rather extraordinary. We'd been bumping our way across the desert, and the tarmac road seemed quite a godsend, really. But we had a heavy night's rain, and then we saw the purpose of this, because the roads were made, have been covered with some tar material, a byproduct of the oil wells, and when it was wet, it was just like glass, and the roads were built up on embankments in many cases, and we had quite a few trucks that slid off and finished in the bottom of the ditch until we got used to it. And they were really, when they were wet, they were really treacherous. But we then moved on from there. Mainly the main body of the battalion marched, actually, for about 10 days. And this found a few people's feet out. And I remember we had as an OC headquarter company at that time Major Greenwell, whose son later joined the regiment also. And he was, I suppose, about 40, certainly old enough to be fathers of quite a lot of the battalion. And he was an example to everybody. He marched the whole way. I was fortunate then that I was still MTO and as such was running around seeing the convoy was all right and that sort of thing, and consequently I rode most of the way. And we were destined for an area just north of the Great Zab River in Iraq, and between there and the Little Zab River, which was a fairly, it wasn't desert, but it was a fairly desolate part of the world with low scrub and occasional small fields cultivated. And this was what we came to know as the Two Rivers. And we were there till February of 42.
What was your role? Why were you there?
Well, we were there, I think there was a worry that at that time the Germans were attacking down from the Don down towards the Caucasus. Stalingrad on the left, and I think the authorities were concerned that if they got through the Caucasus and they might have invaded northern Iraq. So we were stationed up there. I don't quite know how many miles it would be. It would be quite a long way because we must have been 50 miles south of Mosul. That was the purpose of our stay there, and eventually the area was reinforced with the 10th Indian Division came in later on.
What was life like up there for those number of months or weeks that you were there?
Well, it was rather Spartan, really. We were all in tents, and the weather did get in December and January, got very cold, and we had quite a lot of snow, and we had quite a bit of trouble with the trouble, not the water in the radiators, because we were fairly well drilled on antifreeze precautions, but difficult to start in many cases, it was jolly cold at night. In fact, we were more or less dressed to go to bed, really. So, there wasn't a lot of naffy coming. Eventually, for Christmas, we did get a load of more interesting food and some drink, and that was most welcome. And everybody had a thoroughly enjoyable time for a day or two. But we carried on training. And I remember we were teaching the lads field roll, exercising them on field craft, and there were one or two gazelle about, and we used to stalk these gazelle, and that was good training for field craft, and we managed to shoot the odd one, and that supplemented the rations a little bit. They were quite good eating.
What was food like, by and large?
It was adequate. It was the British Army ration. It was fairly good. If you had a good cook staff, really, but the cook sergeant who thought about the job and used his imagination, it was pretty good. I mean, it could be deadly if somebody just wasn't interested. But I think we fed fairly well. And then we had a system of getting everyone hot bars, and this was by means of what became to be termed Fletcher's rocket. Now, Sam Fletcher was the medical staff sergeant, and a downright infantryman, but he was the in charge of the medical section. And he rigged up, by means of these ubiquitous, flimsy petrol tins, a system of oil and water, and we got a bit of cheap oil, and in fact some from the MT, and then drop this onto water and light it, and then we had a blower going, and this was sufficient to heat water to give the whole battalion bars, which was a terrific thing, really, and it used to roar and bang and so on, this thing, but it worked, and it was a boon, really.
How did supplies come to you during the period? Where was it coming from?
Well, I suppose the base that we were supplied from would be Kirkuk, and it came up with a normal second echelon RASC general companies and petrol and ammunition companies, bringing it up to brigade, and then battalion sent back to brigade for it.
Did you receive mail from home?
Yes, we got mail. We got mail, I suppose, about once a fortnight. I wouldn't be too certain about that, but they seemed to come to reasonably regularly. And I think normally about written about 2 months, 2 to 3 months before. That was a most important element, of course, for morale, and a thing that everybody looked forward to having.
How did you overcome boredom? I thought boredom would have been a problem.
Oh, yes. We tried to keep fairly busy. We're doing quite a bit of training, and we ran each company ran a canteen and this sort of thing. And we remember we had one ENSA concert party came up to see us, and we did quite a bit of sport. We had football, and we did a bit of cross country running, but it's a thing that one had to think about all the time, undoubtedly.
Was there any chance for any leave anywhere?
Not, I think, more than a day or two. We were allowed a visit, I remember, to Mosul over a period of about 3 days, and the were driven up to Mosul in the morning, and they arrived there mid-morning, and they had to report back at 10 o'clock, I think, at night. So they had everybody went up there, but there wasn't any leave to Palestine that or anywhere like that that I recollect.
Did you have much contact with any of the natives in the area?
Really, they came round and sold eggs to us. You'd see them standing by the roadside holding an egg. And one of our number, one of our officers, Ian Pitt, he bought a what's known as a poshteen, which is a cloak, really, with a hood. I suppose made of goat skin. And one of the problems, of course, was communicating. We couldn't really communicate with them. We used to see them driving their herds of sheep and goats quite near. And they came past, and we tried to talk to one or two of them, but it was extremely difficult. They were Kurds, mostly.
Were you quite happy with the morale of the men over this period of time?
Yes, I think so. I think we wouldn't have liked to have been there too long. And of course, we used to get involved. We tried to carry the war in the desert. Well, that the Crusader operation started in November 41. That's when we were in northern Iraq and went on till about the January, I suppose, 42. And we would listen to that, and we used to have we had maps outside the company headquarters and with the latest information on. But I think when we came to move from there, we were quite glad, really.
And when was this move made?
This was, I think we left there on the 4th of February. And the orders were that we were going back to Palestine. We were going to Syria, actually, by the same route that we'd taken before, and back to Kirkuk, and through Baghdad and on east, west, through Habaneer again to Palestine. And then when we got there, we were told we had to turn left instead of turning right, and we were going up to the desert. And that's what we did. I think we had two stops, 1,800 miles, and 2 day stops. And that again, I was still the MTO, and again we had problems of keeping all the vehicles going. In fact, one or two we were. There was four-wheel drive, three tonners that the men were riding in. They were quite useful. We had towed some of these 1,500 weights, but eventually we landed up there. I think that would be. We got to up into the desert on the 25th of February and took over a position in the Gazala line, and we arrived there with only one truck missing, and I had I was disagreement with the Robbie Robinson, who was the LAD officer I mentioned, because I said, we can go and find another half shaft. This thing had broken three half shafts in a period of about 10 days. And he said, it's an absolute complete waste of time. There's obviously something quite wrong with that lorry. You'll have to leave it. So we arrived up minus one. And it had been really quite an experience. But the men got so used to these trips, there would be one representative of each company would leave about an hour before the main body, normally under the second in command, and go on ahead quickly and lay out the next staging area. And we would probably start about 7:30 in the morning, drive through, as I said, for half an hour's break, normally doing 70 or 80 miles, perhaps, depending on the going. And tents would come off, and they'd be up in a short time, and we'd be organised. You know, in half an hour, everybody was settled in, really. And then down they came in the morning. And I don't know when that reveille, I suppose, was probably 6 o'clock, an hour and a half before. And you'd think, you know, half an hour before, God, I'm never going to get off in time. But then you just sort of got thrown on, packed up, and off we went again. And then when we were going up through west of Alexandria, we went through Cairo and up the desert road to Alexandria, and then along the coast road. And there we were given orders that we had to push on as fast as we could. So for the last, certainly west of Mersa Matruh, we went across the desert to Bir el-Talata and onto the frontier, and then across the desert to Cromer, and we were doing 120 miles a day, something of that sort, going on till after dark.
Did you see much sign of previous fighting?
Yes, a certain amount. There was a bit of debris, the old knocked out tank and vehicles and this sort of thing, and remains of stores and positions and that we saw, but not a tremendous lot.
What was the mood of the battalion moving up, knowing that you were going into an action situation?
Well, I think probably the majority, you know, a fairly resigned sort of attitude, and you know, say la guerre sort of business. But I think quite a number were really glad to be perhaps doing something a little bit more active, and going to a new area and that sort of thing.
Had no indications of any men who were reluctant to go into this situation.
Well, I don't remember any. Now there may have been the odd malingerer who purported to have various diseases and disablements and one sort or another, and who possibly managed to persuade somebody to send him back. But I think there were very few, really. I mean, the chaps had been together for quite a long time. They, you know, they knew each other, and we'd been up to strength ever since sailing from England, really.
Can you recall how you actually got into the Gazala line?
Well, we took over the positions which were occupied by the 4th Indian Division. Now, this line hadn't been occupied for very long. At the end of the Crusader operation, they advanced again to Agaila, but they weren't there very long before Rommel came back. And the line settled down more or less north and south from Gazala, the British line, and the Germans were closer in the north, but really quite a long way apart, 30, 40 miles apart in the south. And in our sector, we were about 15 to 20 miles from their forward positions. And we took over these positions. I don't know how long the 4th Indian had been there, but probably not more than 3 or 4 weeks. And really had to develop the positions and improve them, see to the mining and the wiring and all that, and that's what we were mainly concerned with.
Can you describe the box you were in and the dispositions that you took up?
Yes, they were, as you say, boxes. In other words, they were completely surrounded by mines and wire with specified gaps. Certainly, I don't remember more than two. There was one out to the west, and then, of course, one back to the rear. And we were more or less with two companies on a square, pretty well square formation, with two companies forward on a slight ridge, and two companies behind, and then in between the in a little nullah battalion headquarters and the support company which had then been formed had its detachments out. I mean, the anti-tank guns were out, and with the rifle companies and the mortars and on. One of the main difficulties, of course, was the shortage of water. And for all that time in the desert from February, when we got there, to when the battle started, everyone was on half a gallon a man a day. And this was, I think, 4 pints for the cookhouse, a pint for washing, a pint for in your water bottle, and I can't remember about the last pint, but that was until, you know, we got used to it, and it got hotter, because when we first arrived in the desert, it was cool. Well, certainly at nights, the nights were cold, and then it got hotter, and the lack of water became really quite a problem. But we filtered everything. We, I suppose, we washed in the same water we used for a week, changed it. But I think generally people were pretty fit, really.
Before we go on further with life in the box, Major, can you describe the desert?
Of course, it isn't true desert. I suppose the geography people would call it semi-desert. And you have little depressions. You would have small growth of scrub and this type of thing. And then some was, you come onto very sandy ridges, and then other parts would be very rocky and stony. And this was one of the skills, really, of drivers, at choosing the route. They didn't want to go into the soft sand. They didn't want to go into the real rocky bit. So choosing a route for each individual driver was quite a skill. But where we were, the digging was easy. I mean, you could have dug it out with a spoon. So from that point of view, it was grand. And particularly to start with, there were quite a number of wildflowers about. And I remember lying, when we first got up there, lying on the desert, and looking up at the fantastic array of stars, and the night-scented stock was flowering, and it was really absolutely beautiful. And then, of course, during the days, everything got burnt up, and that went, and then later on in April, May, and that the flowers were withered, and the thing became more like a desert. We had occasional sandstorms. It wasn't there. It was back at El Alamein where we had some terrible Khamsin sandstorms. But generally speaking, we weren't too bothered. And the bird life was interesting too. There were a few birds about. And it was one of my hobbies, and I was interested. And driving along, you'd see a hoopoe was flying along in front of you, and stopping. Putting their crests up, and that was absolute joy. And I remember once, just in front of our position, there was this little bit of a grassy area, and 30 or 40 bees was flying over the top. You know, just found some insects there to attract them, and crested larks too. They were about, so that lightened things up a little bit.
Spent time talking about life. In the box.
Well, we'd we would stand to just before dawn, to half an hour after daylight,